this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 33. Can you believe 33? And today I'm joined once again by Jill Gordon, a Charles Dana professor of philosophy at Colby College, and Sarah Brill, associate professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, two frequent now guests on The Digital Dialogue, and I really appreciate both of your willingness to come on yet again, and also just the notion that this is an ongoing dialogue, and part of the idea of the digital dialogue was and is to cultivate communities of dialogue, and I've really appreciated your ongoing commitment to that, and to not only my work, but the work that we're sort of doing together here at the Ancient Philosophy Society. So we're gathered here in Michigan, at Michigan State at East Lansing for the 10th gathering of the Ancient Philosophy Society. And so what we thought we would do is talk a little bit today about Catherine Zuckert's keynote address that she gave last night. And that was called Two Platonic Paradigms of Philosophy, Socrates and Timaeus. And so I thought maybe the best way to begin is to talk a little bit about what we think she was trying to do in that paper, and then we'll see where our discussion takes us from there. So does someone want, yeah.
Sure. I mean, one thing that I really appreciated about the paper is that it's working on so many levels. Mm-hmm. On one level, it's an interesting interpretation of one dialogue primarily, the Timaeus, but mm-hmm. also the Republic. On another level, I think she's saying something very interesting about what Socrates models as a philosopher, the mm-hmm. philosophical life he models. And I think she's also saying something interesting about Plato's project mm-hmm. with regard to the dialogues as right. vehicles right. for showing us many modes or models yeah. of philosophical right. inquiry or inquiry yeah. more generally.
Right,
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Yeah, if I could just jump on that, I think one of the things that I thought her paper did really nicely is call to our attention the reasons why Plato might write a dialogue in which a character produces a flawed argument right. or an argument right. that in some way fails to persuade, because it reminds us of this sort of critical dimension of the dialogue. So, you know, part of her thesis is that a traditional approach to the Timaeus, namely that it lays the foundation for the political project that is conducted in the Republic. Part of her thesis is to challenge that and say that what it really does is it shows us the tension between the things that belong to the human and the sort of mathematically precise ways of calculating the cosmos. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of dramatizing tension and the critique that dramatization is able to produce, it was really rich, I thought, as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the tension between Timaeus and his concern for nature and natural yeah. things and his attempt to account for the cosmos, and she made the point that Socrates is about human affairs and trying to figure those out. Yeah. And then I thought it was really interesting when she was talking about Socrates' silence in the Timaeus yeah. and the meaning of that silence.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to add, I think, two things. One, I failed to mention that another aspect of, or maybe what motivates her investigation here is wanting to argue against the very common view that, you know, the Republic and the Timaeus have this intimate relationship mm-hmm. and the content of what Timaeus is saying is intending to be a sort of prelude
mm-hmm. yeah.
to the city that's created in the Republic.
Yeah. I thought at the very end, this is skipping way ahead, but at the very end, I thought it was really interesting when she sort of, it was in the question and answer period, I think, and it was almost like an afterthought, but I thought it was really pretty powerful comment where she said, maybe part of the point is that the just city can't go to war,
yeah.
right? So that
yeah.
whole question of this relationship between
yeah.
the city and speech from the Republic and that whole theme
yeah.
of let's with Critias for example, right?
Yeah.
Let's see the city at war, and so I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean it does the whole question of justice is such a nice way into some of the things that she was talking about, right? Because on the one hand, it seems like a point that she made consistently and that seems right is that justice for Plato requires human intervention and action. And at the same time, we have to think that, you know, Plato is operating in a kind of intellectual milieu in which asking about justice was not necessarily distinct from asking about the cosmos and the, you know, overall workings of the universe. And so trying to figure out how human action fits in with that, like where ethics stands with cosmology and where politics stands with cosmology is really interesting.
And of course, then she introduces erotics.
That's right.
And I thought it was very interesting how in one gesture to move us away from this singular association between Timaeus and Republic, she talked about the ways in which the Timaeus was evocative of the symposium. You know, this banquet of speeches, the several references using that phrase, a banquet of speeches, and the fact that Socrates gets dressed up for the event as he had done in the symposium.
Well, I'm just going to ask you, Jill, because I know that's related so much. That's the sort of question of the role of Eros in a dialogue like that, Timaeus, and also more generally. But I remember when you were on the digital dialogue and we had this kind of conversation about the grand, what I was calling, at least as I recall, the sort of grand cosmological conception of Eros. And I wonder if we could think a little bit more about the different kinds of Eros that she was laying out in that.
Actually, I would like to have a slightly more detailed conversation with her at some point, because I think there is a very strong presence of this kind of cosmological Eros in the Timaeus, and that it's linked to the human soul's connection to this noetic world that's created before humans get created. And I think a lot of what happens in the later parts of Timaeus' speech, where you have the degeneration of the physical body, or it is the physical body, which is a degeneration of the divine soul, it's really a as I read the dialogue, more of a focus on epithymia. Epithymia is the bodily, grounded, and ultimately flawed aspect of humans, as Timaeus describes them. And Eros is much more closely associated with what's divine about humans.
Because I was going to, I mean, so does... So was were you feeling like that disjunction between? I mean, she had a pretty strong claim about Timaeus's lack of understanding about Eros, and and actually would be interested in what you both think about that sort of. I thought she really rooted it in her in Timaeus's inability to consider the feminine, consider the material in certain kinds of ways.
And I think I would agree with her. That was very interesting. Those are strange passages in the Timaeus, and I hadn't quite thought about it in the terms that she had, namely that you find out late in the Timaeus that this entire race of beings, they're all male. And it's females only come later after the men have lived bad lives and reincarnated. They're weak or lack courage. And I think that is a very interesting way to look at Timaeus's flawed understanding of Eros. So I think I would agree with her on that. It's interesting.
Well, and the tradition of sort of rewriting women's generative and reproductive capacities is long, right? I mean, we can go back to Hesiod. So it would be wonderful to be able to make the claim that Plato is critically evaluating those modes of discourse. And what's crazy about the Timaeus is that basically all other mortal living beings are construed with respect to their distance from the male. So not just women, but animals. So there's this real denial of any real ontologically different status between living beings that seems very strange when you compare it to things like the Phaedrus, where, you know, varieties of animals are talked about, or the Phaedo, for that matter, where varieties of animals, you know, are there's a very rich account of animality. So I think that's also a really interesting point.
But I wonder if, and this brings up the point about the symposium, so I wonder, as maybe as a way of juxtaposing the Socratic
understanding or expertise, so to speak, in things erotic. And the speech that he gives in the voice of Diatima, that really is, I mean, first of all, that he gives it in the voice of Diatima, that it that it sort of introduces a at least a heterosexual conception of Eros after all of these same-sex conceptions that are really very male-centered from the previous speeches in the symposium. So I wonder if we could think a little bit more about, you know, the distinction between Timaeus's conception of Eros and Socrates.
Right. Well, this, I don't know if this is exactly the direction you're going, Chris, but I think this is where you start to see the political dimension also of her argument.
Right.
You know, she's making the point that the beings in Timaeus's likely story could never have been the beings who populate the ideal city in the Republic because they, first of all, in the Republic you have this very distinct description of types of souls, some of which are, you know, suited to rule and so forth, and they're all the same as Timaeus describes them. And then again, this issue of gender. In the Republic, you are dependent on capable women taking a particular role in the life of the city in a way that's just not possible with the beings that Timaeus describes.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow up with that, the Republic reference is really interesting, right? Because there the claim is that, you know, sexual difference is not a basis for politics. So you can't exclude women from the political arena and still operate with a fully functioning city. So looking at the difference between that and whatever kind of politics might be suggested by the Timaeus is I think really interesting.
But I mean, of course, that's also so fraught. I mean, you know, just ascribing those kinds of certain kinds of political views to these texts in the from the Republic is like, okay, well, who's holding those views and how do they relate? That was part of the question that was yesterday. They're relating to the individual soul, or is this really a kind of genuine political kind of account?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And you know, the point to go back to the Republic where we get this sort of denial of the political necessity of sexual difference, you also end up that being followed immediately with the difference between strength, right? And so, you know, we might want, like when I teach that section with my students, I say, look, you know, strength is not a function of nature. Strength is a function of convention as well. Who gets fed what and under what circumstances? And so it seems like Plato gives us the tools to perform that analysis, even if he himself doesn't have his characters perform it. So we can critique him with the very tools that he gives us.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that I'm really wondering about is what are we being told? Maybe this is a way to get at the the question of what's Plato's teaching in a robust sense, not in a dogmatic sense. But if we listen to the dialogues and if we allow Catherine did yesterday, the Timaeus to talk to the Republic and maybe even bring in the symposium as dialogues and recognize that something is being said about the nature of Eros, let's just take that as an example, or the nature of politics, it becomes really interesting and difficult to think about what we're being taught, you know?
I'm not sure, again, if this is what you're getting at, Chris, but I was struck by things Catherine said at the end of her paper about these two models that she's presenting, the Socratic and the Timaean. Is that the adjective?
That's good.
They're both insufficient in a certain way.
Right.
And, you know, this, I think, tells us something very interesting about Plato's project and what he's sort of presenting to his audience. So you've got this vision of someone very interested in scientific, mathematical order, and it is an account. It's a very robust account. It's a detailed account. It's a fascinating account, but it's insufficient in many ways. But I think Catherine was also willing to say, so is Socrates' human-oriented vision. And it brought to my mind a little bit the work that Ruby Blondel was doing in her book, The Play of Character, where she's looking at what she calls the different avatars of Socrates, the way in which Socrates appears and says and believes different things in different dialogues.
Right.
And she reads that as Plato sort of working through different modes of doing philosophy, including what philosophy is going to look like when Socrates is gone.
That's great.
I mean, it does bring up again the whole question of silence, and because she did at the end talk a little bit about the sophist, about the statesman, and how we're supposed to read that silence.
I mean, I think it also it really points again to the necessity of thinking of Plato as doing a kind of intellectual and cultural critique. And that's so, I think, important to emphasize in the face of the history of talking about Plato as having doctrines.
Yeah.
So that's right. There just seems to be something that is really missing from that understanding of what Plato is doing. It's one thing to say he has a consistent constellation of questions that are addressed from a variety of perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
It's another to say that here is what is philosophically meritorious in the dialogues,
right.
And we call it a doctrine, and everything else we sort of put to the side.
Yeah.
And I think in the context of a discussion of Timaeus, which was
in
the history of the reception of Plato, and in particular in Neoplatonic thinking. I mean, it became the Plato's cosmology, and also, of course, to say nothing of the way the church took it up and all of that. So it becomes really interesting when you start thinking, as you were mentioning, Jill, before, that we need to recognize, or she, actually Catherine mentioned it, that we need to recognize that Timaeus is not Socrates and Timaeus is not Plato.
Right.
But I think that's also one of the things that's challenging from my perspective is to think about, not dogmatic Plato,
right.
But there's a teaching.
Mm.
And in a dynamic sense.
Which, I mean, that itself I think is central, although maybe not spoken explicitly in Catherine's paper, the two models of philosophy that are in the title of her paper really, I think, make this gesture toward, there's this author, Plato, who has presented us with these two models. Why? What is he doing?
Right.
What is he up to? What do these two models show us?
But, your work, Jill, about, turning toward philosophy and that being part a central core of Platonic teaching. So I wonder what we take from that in relation to Catherine's paper, because...
Yeah.
It is turning. She ends this. She ends with this really pretty, I thought, compelling idea about about the philosophical life and about what Plato's trying to teach us.
Well, I mean I thought her discussion in the Q&A about the differing provocations that beauty offers for Timaeus and Socrates. Is really helpful in terms of the point that you were just making, that Timaeus is stricken by the beauty of the orderly motion of the heavens, and that moment is somehow constitutive of the kind of philosophizing that he's going to do, and then Socrates is stricken by the beauty of another human being. So maybe we could play that out a little bit more, the difference between those two stances with respect to the beautiful.
I do think, I mean, in some ways that's what's been sort of here in our discussion, and also I think yesterday is this, we could put it in these terms, Socrates and the whole story about the second sailing and the turn away from nature and the turn towards human affairs. Okay, that's one thing. I wonder if there's not at least a gesture back to the natural order and Socrates' relation, and at least opening up the question of what is Socrates' relation to the natural order, and what is the human, more broadly speaking, the relation of human affairs to the natural order.
This is, I find this interesting or provocative in one sense. I'd never had this thought before. But if you look back at Diotima's teaching to Socrates and look at the so-called ladder of love, there are these things in there that many of us think, oh, that's an odd thing. You love the laws, the beauty in the laws. Okay, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But nothing in there says that the initiate falls in love with or sees the beauty of the natural order. Is that, that's not part of the ladder, is it?
That's very interesting.
I don't know. I'd have to look back more closely. That would be an interesting thing to think about. Although there is this movement, right, from individuals mm-hmm. to certain kinds of whole, right, to this sort of a more holistic mm-hmm. vision,
right,
that theoretically, at least, even if it's not explicit in that text, could include the natural order, especially if we add things that Socrates says in the Phaedrus or other places about nature.
Yeah.
And yet, I think it's just interesting that it's not said explicitly, right?
Yeah.
So laws are mentioned, right? Beautiful laws are mentioned, but not
Yes, so what isn't produced is an astronomy. Yeah. What's produced is a move from human bodies to their souls, not from natural bodies to cosmic souls.
Right.
That's very interesting.
But I mean, and from my perspective and my thinking, this is a little bit related to some of the stuff that I was trying to work out at the end of my Aristotle book on truth and justice,
mm-hmm.
is that the relationship, that what's critical is the relationship between our even perception of individuals and our attempts to do justice to how they show themselves to us, in the context of a cosmos that is ordered to some degree, and that order is intellectable to some degree.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, just to give a plug for the laws in that context, right? Like in the laws you get this attempt explicitly to kind of wed an experience of the orderly motion of the heavens
mm-hmm.
to an experience of the beauty of the well-ordered city.
So you can sort of think
of it as producing this sort of either marriage or interesting third alternative, that the Athenian stranger finds the city beautiful, Socrates finds humans beautiful, and Timaeus finds nature beautiful. But finding the city beautiful seems to require this sort of combination of finding the heavens beautiful and also this capacity to legislate toward the divine.
So then what's now emerging, at least as we think about this, seems to me that we have sort of these encounters with individuals, and out of that, in a certain sense, grows these political organizations, these communities. And I should be interested to hear about sort of the polis and the oikos in that context, right? Just particularly coming off of Emma's paper and the problematizing of the oikos in this little story that maybe I would... I don't know if I believe this, but I at least could lay it out. So you have these relations with individuals that then sort of grow into somehow these communities.
Yeah.
That then those communities, first maybe in the household, but then a political, also are in the context of a cosmos, and that cosmos is always operating in the political organizations and
And I think there's something else, too, and Chris, you might have something to say about this, because I think it's related to the paper that you gave. So, yeah, there are individuals, there's the oikos, there's the polis, but if you look at the dialogues, what they depict is really these other communities. They're not the oikos, they're not the polis, they're... I don't know, communities of friends, but they're pederastic communities often.
Right.
And so I think that raises some interesting issues about, so what is this model of philosophy? Where is it? Like, what's the topology? Where is it taking place?
Right. I mean, I think just thinking out loud about that, with regard to Socrates, that's what I was trying to delineate as a Socratic politics. And the place of that is between people wherever they meet,
right?
And so it comes into being and passes away as it, to the degree to which people can engage with one another in ways that are transformative in I would say in positive ways. Now, I mean, there's also ways of being together that are destructive and that we need to think of. I don't want to minimize that.
This, I think, resonates so nicely with the Phaedo as well, where, so much of the project there seems to me to be how to remove yourself from that intellectual community and yet still be assured that it will continue as such.
Right.
So Socrates, trying to figure out how to exhort or encourage mm-hmm. his friends to philosophy rather than to right. mourning his loss. Yes.
Right.
So you do get this interesting, in a sense, there's a kind of familial structure there. They love him mm-hmm. and they're going to be sad when right. he's gone.
Right.
But he's really trying to shift that into a kind of intellectual continuity
right.
or something along yeah. those lines.
This is so interesting. So one of the things that makes me think of, Sarah, is thinking in a new way about Socrates' utopia, right? So how is he out of place or strange yeah. or different?
Right.
Well, one way in which he is, yes, he has this community of friends. The same names pop up. They're brothers. They're related yeah. to each
right.
other. But there's a kind of promiscuity about Socrates
yeah.
as well. He'll
yeah.
talk to anyone.
Yeah. Sure.
And he talks to a lot of people who are not part
right.
of that
yeah.
right.
inner circle in a way that's still parallel to those. He's still trying
yeah.
to engage in some philosophical
right.
way.
Right. Well, and I think that was what was sort of nice about Anne Marie's commenting on my paper, because she was asking us to sort of think about who this auditor is
right.
that frames
yeah.
the Protagoras.
Yeah.
And, it forced me to also think a little bit about... Socrates being willing to do this to just people that he meets. They might not be his great friends, right?
Yeah.
And yet there's a familiar, I mean, this person clearly knew Socrates. I mean,
yeah.
he felt comfortable enough to joke with him a little bit about
yeah.
Alcibiades, that they, you know.
Yeah.
So, Socrates certainly, his reputation precedes him in some ways, I'm sure. But I do think it brings up the larger issue that I've been struggling with, and also in teaching and everything and all of that, about how you respond to the unfamiliar and the strange and the people who aren't part of the so-called intellectual community or whatever community you're talking about. How do you
yeah.
do that in a way that at least opens a possibility of a wider conversation and
yeah.
of the community?
Yeah, I mean, just again on that note, right, Socrates says to Cabes and Simmias, like, search all of Greece,
right?
Right? So there are probably people, and people
right.
who, who don't speak Greek as well,
yeah.
and look amongst yourselves also.
And I think that bringing the Phaedo into this is
yeah.
is interesting, because I mean, I'm hoping to at some point in this larger project to bring in, talk about the Phaedo and do some work on that, because this whole issue of mythology and
yeah.
his worry about
yeah.
that.
That's
and
right.
what happens when if part of Socrates' project is to make things strange and to instill a kind of openness to a kind of alienation,
yeah.
from your own beliefs and from
yeah.
your, thoughts that you might actually have this thing figured out, then how do you sustain that,
Yeah.
He seems to have cultivated it himself
yeah.
pretty
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. Well, I wonder if there isn't something to tying this into the, powerfully imagistic and poetic nature of
right.
the dialogues. And part of the way you maintain that estrangement is to create images of it, and images that include images of yourself
right.
and those around you. So that there might be a way in which, philosophical poetics is a vehicle of this
right.
kind of life of estrangement or
yeah.
life of utopia that makes it bearable.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe we're at the core of what Plato's project really
yeah.
in part is, that
yeah.
that the writing of this
yeah.
was the decisive move for a certain kind of, or maybe a certain kind of gesture against an ultimate mythology,
yeah.
because now they do, although he sacrifices by writing them something of the living
yeah.
speech that Socrates is worried about,
yeah.
or at least talks about in the Phaedrus, but he gains, a vehicle by which to talk to us and by which the conversation
yeah.
continues.
That's right. Yeah.
And I wonder. So maybe we could sort of conclude our discussion here by talking a little bit about the Ancient Philosophy Society and this sort of. This is 10 years now,
yeah.
and you both have been an important part of the real thriving of the society. And I think it was striking me yesterday as I was thinking about my paper and also sort of the conference here and the great part about having new faces and new voices in the society and along with some of the voices and faces that we've had throughout the 10-year period, to think about the community, mm-hmm. the communal dimension mm-hmm. of the society and what mm-hmm. and what we've really built.
Yeah, it's certainly what keeps me coming back yeah. all the yeah. time. I mean, I just... in fact, you know, we've talked philosophically about friendship, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
there are people yeah. at this conference, you guys included, whom I might see once a year.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, you pick up where you left off.
Yeah,
and,
that's
you
right.
know, it's just really such a nice atmosphere. And I think others feel it. You know, newcomers are
yeah.
fairly quickly brought in
right.
to that community.
Right.
Yeah.
It's and one of the things I appreciate, too, about it is that there's a rigor to the work, but it's always it does have that spirit of friendship, and it
yeah.
and you know the agonistic dimensions are really minimized.
Yeah.
I think you
yeah.
know we may people disagree with each
oh,
other
yeah,
for sure, but it's always and part of that is that we've got now 10 years we've got
yeah.
a history with each other.
Yeah, and I mean it's our disagreements seem really fruitful.
Right.
They seem to just. Be the things that provide resources for posing new questions
right.
and really we can sit. And in that sense, it's a extremely supportive.
Right.
But I also want to give a shout out to your Digital Dialogue series.
Yes.
I mean, I just think that I was telling Chris a little bit ago that occasionally I'll come home and pour a glass of wine and sit and listen to a
yeah.
podcast. And it's such a nice way to reconnect, you know, not simply with friends, although that's the case, but with, you know, an intellectual community and really hear about what one another are working on. So we should give a thanks to you as
Thank
well
you.
For
I
this
appreciate
project.
It. I mean, in many ways, the idea for doing this was to see if I could, originally it was to, can I create or build a community around some of the philosophical ideas that I had? And then I started thinking, wait a minute, I have that. You know, if I could just invite, you know, people from the ATS and other,
yeah.
you know, around
yeah.
into it, and it would be a way of continuing the conversations that we have, you know, every April,
yeah.
and then maybe at SPEP if we meet, but we can have them more often because of this medium and that
mm-hmm.
what it affords us, and I've really enjoyed it, so it's been really great.
If I could just add another thing, you really have succeeded in creating a community, and
mm-hmm.
I'll just give two examples. Your colleague in classics at
uh-huh.
Penn State
uh-huh.
is working on some similar things to what
right.
I'm doing, and
right.
so we started emailing.
Markman?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And then I've also communicated with your students. You know, I've
right.
looked at their blogs
mm-hmm.
and their class projects, and I've thought about, well, maybe I want to do something
yeah.
like that
mm-hmm.
at Colby, and so I've asked them some questions,
yes.
and they've been very generous.
They have. That, it's really, and,
so.
You know, it's amazing to me when, you know, when these kinds of connections come out, and is this is a whole new medium to be able to comment on
yeah.
blogs, and I mean, you know, it takes some getting used to. There's a public nature to it that's
yeah.
kind of disconcerting. You don't know exactly what the dimensions of that are, but I've really appreciated people's willingness to participate in that. In fact, that reminds me of the Mark Munn thing. We've got to get you and Mark on the Digital Dialogue
yeah.
for after I think the semester. You guys were talking about it.
Yeah.
So now, before you go back to after your sabbatical is
yeah.
over, we got to get you on it. So, well, thank you. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Next year.
Oh, next year. We're going, and that's right. Next year we're doing Utah. We're
right.
going to be at Sundance.
Right.
So those of you listening, if you're interested in some of the things you've been hearing on the Digital Dialogue, if you visited the Ancient Philosophy Society .org blog and website, we invite you to submit a paper for the Sundance Conference. It's going to be great. Michael Shaw is going to host us, and it's going to be all of us at Sundance, and we're going to have the whole place rented out, I think.
April 14th through 17th,
yeah.
2011.
Great, great. So, but we will definitely have, hopefully, opportunities for us to talk before that, but that is going to be a really a special event, I think. So, thank you, Sarah and Jill, for coming on
thank
the Digital
you.
Thank you, Chris.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under Creative Commons Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.